First, much of the country is still in the midst of a massive heat wave, and it's reaching us here in Wisconsin with the temperature creeping into the 90s in the southern half of the state. But even within communities, not everyone experiences heat waves in the same way. A new report digs into the concept of urban heat islands, where certain parts of cities are significantly hotter during heat waves. The analysis from the organization Climate Central finds that about 41 million Americans in cities across the U.S. live in these urban heat islands. People living and working in those areas have higher energy costs, worse air pollution, and higher rates of heat-related illness and mortality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a city? Have you noticed that parts of your community are hotter than others? Do you see solutions in your area? How prepared do you think your community is for climate change and higher temperatures? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Gerard leads digital communications and media relations for Climate Central. That's a climate change research organization. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Can you give us an overview of what your organization found when you looked at these heat islands across cities across America?
We were able to look at a neighborhood by neighborhood analysis of how the built environment makes residents feel even hotter than temperatures that are soaring this summer. And we found that in a number of places, in virtually every city we looked at, temperatures were anywhere from 8 to 12 degrees hotter than they ordinarily would be because of the built environment, because of the characteristics of some of these neighborhoods.
And I got to say, I've had experiences where I thought, oh, this part of whatever city is hotter than this one, just, you know, walking five blocks or something like this, and assumed it was all in my head, honestly. No, it really can vary that much within, you know, one community like that.
It was not in your head. As you walk through different environments, you're going to go through areas where you've got more shade, where there are more parks, where there are buildings with darker building materials, where there are paved surfaces that are radiating heat back at you. And these are the kinds of changes that residents experience. And it is literally hotter in the places where you've noticed these pockets of what seems to you to be radiating heat.
Let's take a look at the one city in Wisconsin you looked at. That's Milwaukee. A significant portion of the city has these heat islands. What did you see there?
It varies. You've got, and this is not dissimilar from other cities, you've got this sort of checkerboard approach where some neighborhoods are clearly showing these built environment traits that are amplifying heat. And in some cases, it's 6, 7, 8 degrees. In some cases, it's even more than that of extra heat, because of these characteristics of the neighborhood that they're walking through or living in.
It may not sound like a lot, 6 or 7 or 8 degrees, but over the course of a hot day and a hot night in a heat wave, how much difference can that make when it comes to our well-being?
It can be the difference between uncomfortable and dangerous. This is a significant human health threat. And, you know, when you have people who are experiencing temperatures in the 80s and 90 degrees, when you have these neighborhoods that aren't cooling down overnight, where it's 75 or 80 degrees overnight, it coincides with increased emergency room visits. It is placing people who have heart conditions or asthma and other respiratory conditions at greater risk. It's particularly tough on the elderly and on the very young. So it's not just uncomfortable. These urban heat islands, these hot neighborhoods, it's putting their residents at greater health risk.
We are talking about the concept of urban heat islands. Peter Gerard is with us from the group Climate Central. They did an analysis of cities all over the U.S., including Milwaukee here in Wisconsin, found, depending on how neighborhoods are built, a pretty wide range of temperatures when things heat up during heat waves. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences in a community here in Wisconsin or elsewhere. Have you seen that kind of variation? What kind of changes in a community do you think could help make a difference? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter, let's visit some of our Midwestern neighbors. What did you find in places like Chicago and Minneapolis?
It's really interesting. So Chicago has a surprisingly high percentage of its neighborhoods and therefore its population experiencing 10 degrees or more of additional heat because of the built environment in which they live. Almost 500,000 people in Chicago are experiencing this 10-degree temperature increase, which is really significant, and it amplifies exactly the health risks that I talked about. And then when you look at Minneapolis, if you look at 8 degrees, which is still a relatively high threshold of additional heat, nearly half the people living in Minneapolis or the, you know, urban areas surrounding it are experiencing that kind of additional heat. So both cities, obviously different sizes, but they're experiencing some of that same urban heat island effect that's exposing some but not all residents to additional heat.
What are you hoping people in charge or decision makers in cities, I think probably even smaller communities, can do with this information? Are there things we can do to change that built environment and hopefully limit the impact of these heat islands?
There are, and they're not all expensive sort of, you know, generational projects where you're rebuilding or rezoning a city. Some of them are really simple. One of them is plant trees. One of the characteristics of neighborhoods where you see these urban heat islands, elevated temperatures, is often fewer trees, less shade, less grass, fewer impermeable surfaces or permeable surfaces. They're more paved, and changing some of those characteristics makes a difference. Lighter colors make a difference. Building materials, and then in kind of larger ways, roofs are one of the most significant contributors to this urban heat island effect. You can think about dark colored, you know, roofs that are attracting heat instead of radiating it. And in some cities, light colored and reflective roofing materials are making a difference. So are rooftop gardens and what they call green roofs, where an entire roof is planted. On a neighborhood level, this can make an amazing difference.
I don't know if your report goes into this, but are there communities that are prioritizing these kinds of changes?
We know about some anecdotal stories and some evidence sort of here and there, but on a broad scale, and we didn't explore it as part of this analysis, but on a broad scale, I don't know that it's happening in an organized or government-driven way.
Now, as I understand it, within communities, not everybody is affected equally by these heat islands. People with a lower income, often people of color, more likely to be in these heat islands. What did you see across the country when you looked at these maps of cities?
One of the first things we looked at was where the neighborhoods were and what some of the characteristics of the neighborhoods were where we're seeing this additional heat. And although it's not part of the analysis, we have looked, and this urban heat islands is something that we've studied for a couple of years now. There is absolutely a correlation between redlined neighborhoods, neighborhoods where banks weren't lending to homeowners, and they're typically Black and brown and lower income communities. They frequently show the characteristics that show up in the urban heat island analysis. They're hotter.
I want to get into another consequence here. We focus some on the health impacts of being in a heat island. Energy costs, obviously, if our neighborhood is hotter, if we have air conditioning, we're going to run it more. That's going to, well, generate more climate change pollution, and it's going to cost people more to keep up with those temperatures. How big an impact does that have?
It's meaningful, and it's particularly meaningful when you think about the correlation between lower income neighborhoods and these neighborhoods with elevated heat. The people who can least afford a big electric bill are often those who need to spend more to keep their homes cool.
And if they have air conditioning in the first place, and this is another big difference, possibly people at the most risk here may not have AC in the first place. Is that another part of the concern?
Absolutely it is. There are people who don't have air conditioning or who can't keep an air conditioning maintained. If an air conditioner breaks in some cities during really hot spells, that's not merely uncomfortable. That's a significant health risk.
Talking to Peter Girard with Climate Central. That's an organization that recently conducted an analysis on urban heat sinks, these heat islands in cities around the country. Coming up, we'll also hear from a Wisconsin researcher who took a close look at the impact of heat islands in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, your neighborhood, or parts of your community particularly hot during heat waves? When you walk, bike, or drive in your neighborhood, do you see lots of green or lots of gray? That can tell a big story about how your neighborhood absorbs heat. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about urban heat islands. A Milwaukee citizen science project last summer found that there can be up to a 10-degree difference between the hottest and coolest parts of the city. Now we're taking a look at how heat islands work, what causes them, what cities can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations in your own community. That's 800-642-1234. Peter Gerard stays with us from Climate Central. Now, Woonsup Choi is an associate professor in the Department of Geography at UW-Milwaukee. He's done research on heat islands in the Milwaukee area. Woonsup, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
In your research, Woonsup, where did you find in Milwaukee the worst kind of heat islands? What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was the very high temperature at night with high humidity, the uncomfortable city.
I think we've got a bad connection with Woonsup. I'm sorry about that. We'll see if we can find another way to connect with you. We've got Peter Gerard still with us from Climate Central in the meantime. Let's bring on a caller now. Dwayne is with us in Cudahy. Dwayne, hi.
I'm wondering, when are we going to stop building up and start building down? You go down in the basement, it's nice and cool down there. If this heat gets out of control and we can't make it cooler easily, we can go down.
Dwayne, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Peter Gerard from Climate Central, the idea of finding refuge from the heat and natural cooling with our basements by doing more underground. What do you think?
You know, I think you're getting at 2 points. I mean, your one is you're clearly right, and you're gaining a benefit of being closer to the ground. The other thing is, in our study, one of the characteristics of urban heat islands is building height. It's a hard thing to change in a city that's been built, but you see this with cities like New York and Boston and the East Coast. You see it in Chicago. You know, that building height is making a difference. It's actually making it hard for airflow to cool down the surface. So the idea of changing the way you construct buildings and using more of the underground and less of the above ground, it's consistent with ways that you could live in a warming city.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dwayne, at 800-642-1234. Gene is with us calling from on the road. Gene, hi.
Good afternoon. I'd like to reemphasize the tree planting portion to increase the urban canopy overall and also improve the infrastructure to facilitate that and prolong the average lifespan of urban trees. They're of value not only for, you know, heat islands and cooling, but health and psychological well-being as well. Thank you.
Oh, Gene, hang on, actually. This sounds like you've something you've thought about a lot. Have you been involved with a project or advocating for more trees in your community?
I've been involved with forestry as a professional arborist for 45 years.
Oh, okay. This is your specialty. Thanks a lot, Gene, for sharing that. Peter, I know some communities have done this, more trees, more shade, trying to cool things off. There have been studies where, you know, if you don't work with local residents on maintaining those trees, explaining why they're there and things like that, it can be difficult to make these projects work. Do you have thoughts on successful ways to get those trees that communities need in place?
Absolutely, and it's a really important point. Working with communities and making sure that people understand what the benefits are is critical. Although in brutal days like what we're seeing recently, you know, the shade that they offer is something that people understand readily. And, you know, it's so important. You know, another important aspect of urban trees is their role in absorbing some of the runoff you get in increasingly heavy rain. So there are so many dimensions in which trees added to these neighborhoods that right now don't have enough canopy can benefit everyone across the city.
Thanks a lot for that call and sharing some of your professional expertise there, Gene. I appreciate it. We are talking about urban heat islands, parts of cities in particular, though, you know, maybe a smaller city, maybe even a smaller town might have some of this. Our guest, Peter Girard, his organization did a big study. Climate Central did a big study on cities around the U.S. It can vary 8 to 10 degrees difference from one part of a city to another. Different at night and during the day. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this a problem in your community? Do you have a question about how to solve it? Have you seen solutions in your own neck of the woods? You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email, share your experiences, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let's see. We've got another caller here. Sue is with us in Richland Center. Sue, hi.
Hi. Last summer during the month of August, we were in South Korea in Suwon. Huge city, never felt huge. Really green, tons of green spaces, plants, pots everywhere. Any little open area where you could plant grass, grass was planted. And even though it was sweltering hot, it felt very comfortable. And it also felt more like a small city instead of the massive city it is.
All right, Sue, thanks a lot for that question. And we've got Woonsup Choi back with us now from UW-Milwaukee. Our caller there, Sue, talking about examples in South Korea, actually. Woonsup, do you have thoughts on that? Success in communities there that have helped deal with these heat islands?
Sorry, repeat that question again.
Our caller asked about South Korea providing a good example of cities that have dealt with heat islands. Do you see examples in South Korea?
I haven't really heard much about it, but there are many large cities in South Korea, and then there are many also, I don't know whether it's unique to South Korea, but there are many different community centers where people can go and take a rest. Under like air conditioned environment, and also in on the street, like say for example, large intersections when people have to wait for signal to cross the street, then there are some kind of shade, large shade under which people can wait. So that actually it is very popular during the summertime.
Excellent.
And also it. Yeah.
And Woonsup, when we lost our connection earlier, you were talking about the importance, the differences in temperature at night and how important that is for people's health and more. Can you talk a little more about your research and what you found with that temperature difference during heat waves at night in Milwaukee?
So I examined the heat stress conditions for Milwaukee and also Minneapolis areas. But So generally, what I found was that there are more incidents of higher temperature in the downtown area in both the cities, and that is likely to continue to increase over the next few decades. The limitation was that the resolution of the temperature data was rather poor. So thinking about the data, citizen science project you mentioned earlier, the resolution of the data is quite poor, so I could not have many data points within the city, but it is rather poor. So there are several data points that covers entire Milwaukee and also Minneapolis. So, but still, I found higher temperature in the densely populated areas and lower temperature in the outlying areas, and also the number of days and nights that exceed certain threshold was increasing and is likely to increase in the future.
And our guest, Peter, mentioned earlier, people of color, people lower income tend to be more victims of these heat islands. When you dug into the concentration of heat in Milwaukee and Minneapolis, is that what you found there?
I did not explicitly examine that, but it is a widespread phenomenon around the world because when thinking about the trees, for example, there are more trees and parks in relatively affluent areas in main parts of the many parts of the country or many parts of the world, and also thinking of the density of people and buildings in residential areas, availability of air conditioning, the impact is highly disproportionate.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in South Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just recently read about a professor and a series of graduate students who had developed a very, very highly reflective paint at Purdue, and that they were discussing the possibility of using the paint for the purpose of cooling buildings by painting roofs and things, exteriors of buildings, that the reflectance was so high that I believe it was over 98%.
Mike, I'm going to jump in because you don't have a ton of time, but Peter, your Climate Century report looked at albedo, the reflectivity of a community. Could something as simple as a more reflective paint make a difference potentially?
Absolutely, it could. That's something expressly addressed in the study. And I think your caller was getting to the idea that there could be a point where there's an unintended consequence where the reflectivity of the surface is so high that it's blinding people and causing additional problems. That's certainly something to be considerate of. But in general, lighter surfaces rather than darker that reflect rather than absorb, it can address at least some of the effect that you're seeing with this extra heat in places that suffer from it right now.
Thanks a lot for that call. And thanks to both of our guests for joining us today. We've been talking to Peter Girard. He leads digital communications and media relations for Climate Central. And Woonsup Choi, associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. They joined us for a look at urban heat islands and how communities, even within the same city, can have very different experiences of a heat wave. Very much a variation in temperature, daytime and nighttime.